And at this point, I will turn it over to Harold.
Okay. Okay, we're not going to have a whole lot of business, but a little bit of business. Let me see. Everybody knows that we do occultations, and I see David Dunham is here. And even in Stardust, there's mention of an Apophos occultation. And Elizabeth, our host, has even done some of the simulation stuff connected with Apophos since he was in on the several cometary missions and all kinds of really interesting stuff. For the benefit of people that are new, this is perhaps the most diverse astronomy club in America because we have professionals and non-professionals and everything in between who are all members. And although our speaker is generally a professional, and so on and so forth. So, let's see, now. I think that John wants to announce some of our science fair winners.
Yeah, Jay Miller and I judged the astronomy projects at the Montgomery County Science Fair. And there were three winners. In the junior category, there was Atharv Shete on the melting of comets. He simulated a comet or some cometary material and of various sizes and measured how long it took for them to melt. In the senior category, one of the winners was Dennis Chunikin, who's won before and comes to our meetings. So you're there, Dennis, congratulations. In a really impressive project on minimizing the time to transfer from an Earth parking orbit to a lunar orbit in cases of emergencies. And the other senior project was on looking for periodic motions in pairs of supermassive black holes to look for binaries that might eventually merge and produce an enormous gravitational wave burst. Both of those senior projects were really very, very impressive, very professional. So I look forward to having them talk to us in June. That's John, all about the science fair.
John, don't send me the their email addresses.
I will.
But I can put them on the list.
Okay, yes.
Let me see. Jack, there's going to be a senior Mid-Atlantic Planetarium meeting coming up this month sometime?
Yes, there will be. In 2.5 weeks, on Wednesday, April 21 at 1 p.m., this is a Zoom meeting, Tim Livengood from the University of Maryland and NASA Goddard Space Flight Center will talk about where has all the atmosphere gone, isotope ratios and atmospheric loss from Mars. This will be an update of the talk that he gave to NCA in February 2020. It was such a good talk, we invited him to give it to us too. There is an announcement and a link to an announcement and a link to the Zoom meeting on page 7 of Stardust.
John, I need to interrupt you for a second. John, I need you to send me the winners too.
So. Yes. No, I've already planned to do that.
Thank you very much.
Does anybody else have an announcement that would benefit all of us that I don't know about, which is always possible?
Hal doesn't know everything.
No, I don't. In fact, I know there's a lot of things I don't know much about.
I just posted something to the chat that is only of interest if someone's interested in geology. The Geologic Society of the Oregon Country puts on incredible presentations that are available live via Zoom. And last night's presentation was about recent geologically recent flooding that scoured the scablands of the Northwest. And the author just had some incredible aerial drone photography. It was just stunning to see this. I thought I was, it reminded me of some of the shots that you might get from Mars explorers.
Thank you, Gary. I'm interested in that, and I think a number of our members are. I've even taught geology from Montgomery College once when our geologists quit 3 days before class started. Now we have someone who's better than me who teaches it. I joke that rocks whisper to me, but they shout to Dennis Cosgren, who's our real geologist. I've had some graduate level classes in geology, but I don't have a PhD in geology like he does. And I've not been a USGS employee like he's been. Okay, if anything else, then I'm gonna mute myself and let our vice president give his fantastic introduction, I suspect, to our speaker.
Our speaker this evening is Dr. Tess Jaffe, who's an astrophysicist at the Goddard Space Flight Center and at the Astronomy Department of the University of Maryland. She obtained a BS in Applied Mathematics and an MS in Physics from the University of California at Riverside. And a year later, this is right after her master's degree, and well before her PhD, she published her first paper. She was the lead author on a paper in APJ on an extended region of gamma ray emission. And she used data from the EGRIT instrument on the orbiting Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. She also published that year a brief report on hard X-rays from the active galactic nucleus BL Lacerte, using data from another instrument on Compton. She became a programmer and analyst at Goddard Space Flight Center using data from US spacecraft, and then a programmer at the Science Data Center for the European Space Agency's orbiting gamma ray spacecraft Integral. And in that latter assignment, she was in Versoix, Switzerland. After publishing more papers on X-ray and gamma ray astronomy, and also on cosmological results derived from data obtained by the very important WMAP spacecraft, she obtained a PhD in physics from the Ludwig Maximilians Universität in Munich and the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching, Germany. She then had a postdoc at the Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics in Manchester, England, followed by a postdoc at the Institute for Research in Astrophysics and Planetology in Toulouse, France. She then returned to this area as a research scientist, jointly supporting, supporting research on both high energy astrophysics and on the cosmic microwave background radiation. This was at University of Maryland at College Park and NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. Besides being a major member of the team of the WMAP spacecraft, she then became also a major member of the team for the Planck spacecraft. So two of the major spacecraft doing measurements on cosmology. Between the two, she's worked on every outside the solar system astrophysical and cosmological topic, except G-waves, using data from every part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Really an astoundingly wide scope. She's also made significant contributions on exoplanets from our galaxy and from other galaxies. She's an expert on two topics that occur in many contexts: synchrotron radiation from fast electrons spiraling in magnetic fields. And she's also a co-founder and co-principal investigator on the Imagine Collaboration, which is developing information on the large-scale magnetic field in our own galaxy. This information will be enormously useful throughout astronomy and astrophysics, and she'll be telling us about that this evening.
Wow, thank you. You definitely did your research. I don't usually get that much detail. Yes, I've been around, let's put it that way. I will say that I did my PhD studying cosmology with the cosmic microwave background. And the reason I've ended up where I am now studying the galaxy is because in the same band where we're trying to do cosmology with the microwave background fluctuations, you've also got a lot of emission from the galaxy. And so during my PhD, it was a pain in the derriere. It was something we wanted to get rid of so that we could study the shape of the universe. And then eventually I got really interested in the galaxy and all these foreground emissions. So I started studying the interstellar medium, the magnetized, ionized gas in our galaxy. And in particular, the issue of trying to figure out the magnetic fields in our galaxy, which turns out to be a tricky problem. And I guess kind of like my career, it touches on a whole bunch of different fields of astrophysics and just about every part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So it is indeed a rather eclectic collection of things I have worked on. So the talk today is just gonna be about all of the different things that do go into this kind of work and what's both difficult and interesting about it and what we're trying to do about it. I'm not gonna be giving you any answers today, but just lots of questions and lots of ways we're trying to figure out how to answer these questions. So I will say I am always happy to be interrupted. I'm very informal as a speaker. So I don't know what your usual rules are, but I don't mind if you unmute yourself and shout out, or if you put a question into the chat, I'll try to keep an eye on it. Or if you want to wait till the end, it's entirely up to you, but I don't mind being interrupted. So basically, this is what I'm going to talk about. What we're trying to do and why and how. A lot about what's wrong with the last 10 years worth of work, including my own. There are a lot of problems with it and how we're going to do better. So the broad sweeps of the outline. So some people ask me to give a justification for why I'm interested in magnetic fields. I always thought that was kind of funny, but I've taken their advice to heart, and I always point out to people why we're interested in magnetic fields. Basically because they're everywhere. And there are very few astrophysical contexts where they don't play some sort of role. Anything from galaxy formation, the hydrostatic balance in the interstellar medium, cosmic ray propagation, which is particularly interesting to me, the turbulence in the interstellar medium, its dynamics is strongly affected by the magnetic fields and vice versa, supernova remnant expansions, molecular cloud collapse, star formation, all of these things, the magnetic field plays a crucial role. And a lot of times, in particular, the large scale field of the galaxy is simply ignored because nobody knows what it looks like or quite how it might come into play. The other reasons we should care about it are, like I said, there are foregrounds for the cosmic microwave background. So if you want to study the shape of the universe the way I did during my PhD, you need to be able to understand these foregrounds at least well enough to get rid of them. And they're also a foreground for 21 centimeter background observations, which is another upcoming and very interesting field of cosmology where we'll be able to study the star formation history, the structure formation history of the universe. But 21 centimeter, as you might know, is in the radio, and there's a lot of radio emission from our galaxy. So it's another classic case of where we want to do cosmology, but our galaxy is in the way. And the other topic that I'm becoming increasingly interested in is ultra high energy cosmic rays. So these are very high energy particles that we don't really understand their origin. We don't know how to make and accelerate particles with these high energies. All we know is that we do detect them. And if we want to understand them, one of the first things we want to know is where do they come from? But these are charged particles, which means that they are deflected in the galactic magnetic field on their way to our detectors. So to find out where they come from, you need to know something about their deflection path, which means you need to understand the galactic magnetic field. Does dark matter interact with the magnetic field? No, that is why dark matter is dark, because it does not interact with electromagnetic radiation, and magnetic fields are basically simply a part of that. So as far as we know, no, it does not. However, there are some sort of distant connections. So for example, one of the signatures people are looking for of dark matter in our galaxy would be the annihilation of dark matter particles, which would then produce gamma ray emission, diffuse gamma ray emission, which then you will see where it connects to this problem later on, but it's a distant connection. So just a quick review of magnetic fields. I don't think I need to describe to you guys magnetic fields in everyday life, but just to give you an idea of the strengths of magnetic fields we're talking about. So on Earth, you're talking about things like a Gauss. And on the Sun, which is a normal star, you're talking about a few to maybe even a few thousand Gauss. Then you get into really weird parts of astronomy you may have heard about from other people at Goddard, like magnetars, which might have 10 to the 15 Gauss. I am not sharing my screen. Well, that's bad. I definitely intended to share my screen. But this is the first picture that matters, so there you go. All right, thank you for pointing that out. There we go. Can you guys all see that? Thumbs up?
Yes.
Sorry about that. You didn't see anything, miss anything before, really, just text and my pretty picture. I had tested it before, but not realized I had not shared it again. So magnetars, 10 to the 15 Gauss, huge beasts of magnetic fields. But the kind that we're going to talk about in a galaxy are microgauss, so 10 to the minus 6 Gauss. These are very, very weak magnetic fields, but we can detect them because we study their effects over very long distances. So a little bit of review, I hope, about magnetic fields and charged particles and the way that they interact with each other, essentially. On the left is a cartoon of how we imagine magnetic fields are affected by the bulk motions of ionized gas in the galaxy. And that is where you imagine that the ionized gas is, its dynamics is dominated by some kind of bulk flow, and it's so the magnetic fields are not stopping it, and it just drags the magnetic fields with it as it moves. And so this is the kind of thing that comes into play when you're talking about large-scale galactic dynamics or things like a supernova expansion that basically blows a bubble in a magnetic field and pushes the field to compress it along the edges. But as you may know, the reverse is also true. So magnetic fields are deflecting the trajectories of moving charged particles. So in this case, if you have a magnetic field and a charged particle is moving in that magnetic field, it will spiral around essentially the magnetic field lines. And the other thing that happens is while that particle is spiraling, that means it's accelerating, and an accelerating charged particle emits radiation. And so for the energies of particles that we're talking about, which are in the order of magnitude of GeV, and the magnetic fields in the microgauss that we're talking about, this emission comes out in radio waves. So I think you're probably familiar with how the galaxy looks, but just to start here, this is what it looks like in the optical, but we're going to look at it in other wavelengths. So this is what it looks like. If you look at 30 gigahertz, this is the lowest energy band of the Planck satellite. So this is basically the highest we consider radio, but it's more microwave and getting up there towards sub-millimeter. And this is the process I was just talking about, where this is a cartoon that explains where this emission comes from. If you have a magnetic field that's in the plane of the sky pointed this way, then your electron is going to spiral around it like this and produce emission as it does. That emission will be polarized, and the polarization orientation is going to be perpendicular to the magnetic field. So what you're looking at here is the polarized intensity of this emission all across the galaxy, and these textures imposed on it. This is just a visual processing trick to show you the orientation of the magnetic field that's inferred from this emission. And so what you can see more clearly over here is that in general, the fields are parallel to the galactic plane. It's harder to see that over here, but it's very visible over on this side. But of course, there are other interesting things going on like this, which is called the North Polar Spur. So that's one of our observables. The next one also comes from the Planck satellite. This is all the way a little bit high energy up into the submillimeter. This is dust emission. So the same magnetic field has a tendency to cause dust grains to align with their long axes perpendicular to the magnetic field. And then when they emit thermal radiation, that radiation will be polarized, again, perpendicular to the magnetic field. So the geometry is fairly similar to how it works for synchrotron emission, but it's from a completely different part of the interstellar medium. So that gives us a sort of a complementary view. Is the galaxy radiation polarized because the charged particles are moving in circles? More or less, kind of, sort of. It's basically, you can write it down statistically and derive what you get from an ensemble of particles all moving in a particular magnetic field. Each one is not producing radiation that will necessarily be strongly polarized, but the total of all of them put together from a particular orientation will appear polarized. So this is just the magnetic field of the Milky Way, not of the entire universe. We can't see the magnetic fields of the rest of the universe, except certain ways. So for instance, if you go back here, this is Sen-A. It's a galaxy with big radio lobes. So for instance, we can see magnetic fields in other objects, and I'll show you some studies of magnetic fields in other galaxies. But direct detection of intergalactic magnetic fields is extremely difficult, but it's very, very interesting because nobody really understands primordial magnetic fields or where our galactic magnetic fields come from. So it's a very good question. So this was dust emission that'll be polarized. You can see some of the same features, like the magnetic field is polarized along the galactic plane here as well. But it'll look very different up here. And one reason is that the dust is very thinly distributed about the galactic disk. Whereas cosmic rays go up kiloparsecs into the what's known as the thick disk or the halo of the galaxy. So you're not necessarily looking at the same region of space when you're looking in the same direction because the particle distributions are different. So that's what makes them complementary. Another observable that you can see in the same cartoon is that these dust grains in this magnetic field aligned the way that they are, will absorb starlight. And that means that an unpolarized radiation field from a star will be polarized as it passes through, and we will see the starlight appear polarized. And so this is showing measurements of various measures of individual stars. And the color here shows that the angle of the magnetic field is again parallel to the galactic plane. And then this is 90 degrees away. This is the bottom of the North Polar Spur again. And what's interesting about starlight polarization is that if we can get distances to these stars, then we can start to do 3D studies of the galactic magnetic field. Faraday rotation is one of the oldest ways we've studied magnetic fields in the galaxy. So Faraday rotation is where if you have a background galaxy that's producing polarized emission, where you imagine here, this is the polarization orientation emitted by the galaxy. As it travels through an ionized medium with a magnetic field that's pointed along the line of sight, this polarization orientation is going to rotate as it travels through. And this rotation is a function of wavelength. So if you measure it at several different wavelengths, you will measure different orientations of that polarization. And from that difference, you can measure the strength of the magnetic field along the line of sight. This image is showing a map that's constructed from tens of thousands of individual point sources. These are extragalactic radio sources for which we have measured rotation measures. So to summarize all of this, basically, we have a number of complementary observables. We have synchrotron emission that depends on the perpendicular component of the magnetic field. In other words, perpendicular line of sight, which means in the plane of the sky. And that's actually the perpendicular component is from synchrotron emission or thermal dust emission. But like I said, with different particle distributions. The Faraday rotation measure traces the parallel component of a magnetic field. And each of these observables is dependent on a different particle distribution. The high energy electrons, the cosmic rays, are what produce synchrotron emission. Dust grains produce thermal dust emission. And for Faraday rotation, it depends also on the distribution of ionized gas in the galaxy. And so these are all different populations which have different phenomenology associated with them. So it's not always straightforward to pull out the magnetic field information from these observables. So here's what it looks like in a different galaxy. This is M51, you might recognize. The background image is an optical image. And on top of it is some radio data. The contours are just the radio intensity. And if you can see the little headless vectors, those are showing you the magnetic field orientation. So you can see, for instance, that this orientation has a tendency to follow the spiral structure of the galaxy. And this is interesting. It's perhaps unsurprising. On the other hand, it's not a perfect correspondence. And we don't know for sure that this is what our own galaxy looks like. And that's not what all galaxies look like. So here are some other interesting cases. The one on the left has a spiral structure. It's not quite as pretty, but it's a spiral galaxy seen in the optical as the underlying image again. But the strongest synchrotron emission with the strongest magnetic fields is coming from regions in between these spiral arms traced in the optical. And in the galaxy on the right, it's a completely irregular galaxy. It has no detectable spiral density waves. And yet there's a very nice spiral magnetic field to it, as you see in the radio. So what the connection is between the dynamics of the galaxy and the structure of the galaxy and the magnetic field is not something that we can assume. And we can't see our own galaxy this way. So where are we in the Milky Way? We have all of these complexities. We're in the disk looking through it. And there's a unique challenge just in terms of numerically trying to simulate this to the fact that it's projected onto the sky in a way that is spherical rather than, let's say, Cartesian. But the advantage is that we have some 3D information and we have much higher resolution. So before I go on, I want to divide the magnetic fields into three components, which are, in terms of the physics, arbitrary, but in terms of the observations, are extremely useful. So on the left, I'm defining this as a coherent component where all the magnetic field lines are pointed in the same direction. So if you look down these, you get a very strong rotation measure. If you look from the side, you get strongly polarized synchrotron emission. If you have a completely random magnetic field, then you don't get any polarization and you get no net rotation measure because everything just cancels out. You will see total synchrotron emission, but you will have no orientation information. And in the middle is a component that has been in the past neglected, but is now being recognized as very important. It's sometimes called the ordered random component, sometimes the anisotropic random component, or the striated component. Astronomers love to have a confusion of nomenclature to keep everybody on their toes. This is basically a field where the orientation stays the same, but the sign, the direction, will flip stochastically. So if you look down this, you get no net rotation measure because it cancels out. But if you look from the side, it still has strong synchrotron polarization. And the same is true for dust. So basically, the Faraday rotation is tracing the coherent component. The synchrotron or dust polarization is tracing the combination of the coherent and the ordered random component. And the synchrotron total intensity is tracing the isotropic random component. So if you have those three observables, then you can study the degree of ordering in the magnetic field. How ordered is it versus how turbulent is it? And this is very important to the physics of where it comes from and how it is amplified and that kind of thing. So in principle, what we would like to measure the ordering of the magnetic fields is to be able to divide the polarization signal here by the total intensity signal, to get the ratio. And that tells you about how ordered the magnetic fields are. But I'm showing you the Planck data at 30 gigahertz in polarized intensity only. This is the total intensity that we have. It was measured at 408 megahertz, which is a much lower frequency, longer wavelength. So why can't we just use the total intensity from Planck? Well, the reason is, as I mentioned before, there's a whole bunch of different things going on in the microwave bands that are produced by diffuse emission in the galaxy. And the total intensity here is dominated by other things, not synchrotron emission. And we can't separate them cleanly enough. So you cannot use the total intensity at this frequency to trace synchrotron emission. In the radio, synchrotron is dominating everything. So that's great. You have this total synchrotron intensity from this low frequency radio measurement. Well, why can't you use polarization there? Well, because this is what it looks like. Because of the Faraday effects, I mentioned that Faraday rotation depends on frequency. And the longer your wavelength or the lower your frequency, the more Faraday rotation there is. So what happens is that along the line of sight, there's different degrees of rotation happening and they're canceling each other out. So what that means is that when you look at low frequencies, you have something called the polarization horizon. You can't see polarized emission from very far away, further than roughly a kiloparsec. And so it's all wiped out. You see things that are relatively nearby, but you can't see the galaxy itself. So what we have to do then is compare synchrotron emission at 30 gigahertz with synchrotron emission at 408 megahertz. That means we need to understand its energy spectrum. And that means we need to understand the energy spectrum of cosmic ray electrons because they are directly connected. So that brings us to some fun because cosmic rays are interesting. So I'm going to summarize the problems that we have right now. They can be sort of roughly categorized as the fact that we have a bunch of different models that all roughly match the same observables. The models are not well enough connected to physics. A Bayesian model comparison has not been done, and I'll tell you what that means in a minute. And don't even ask about the treatment of the turbulence. We're, you know, in very early days of trying to do the turbulence, and we're using really awful toy models, and we don't quite understand how bad an assumption that is. So to go into a little more detail on these, because it's very interesting, in fact, here are some of the models in the literature. This is six of them. All of these have been fit to some data. The top three have all been fit to the same data, and yet they don't have the same morphology. This one has been fit to dust, thermal dust emission only, from WMAP. These have been fit to the Faraday rotation measures, the synchrotron emission in total and polarized intensity that I was showing before, but all three of them have been fit to those, and they're very different. This one is fit to galactic pulsars. So I mentioned Faraday rotation. That map I showed was from extragalactic sources, of which we have tens of thousands. We also have some galactic pulsars. And those are very useful because we can measure the distances to them and get the rotation measure, which can give you some 3D information about the magnetic field. The problem is we don't have very many pulsars, nowhere near as many as we have extragalactic sources. So there's some ambiguity in interpreting the pulsar information as a magnetic field model. And this one is based on theory, but it was also fit to some radio data. So why do they all look the same? Why don't they all look the same if they're fitting to roughly the same data? One is the insufficient distance information. You can put the source of the synchrotron emission at different distances, and the end result, when we just have a 2D sky map, will be the same. So these features, for instance, spiral arm emission, we can't tell you just from the synchrotron emission what the distance to those spiral arms is. You also notice that these have reversals where, for instance, the field is going inward along one arm and outward along the next arm. But we don't actually know where those reversals happen. We only know that there are reversals because of the rotation measure data going from positive to negative as you look along the galactic plane. The pulsars would help us with that, but we don't have enough of them. We also don't know the 3D distribution of the cosmic rays. So that means, are you getting more synchrotron emission from this region of the galaxy because there are more cosmic rays there or because there's a stronger magnetic field there? They're degenerate. You can't tell unless you knew the distribution of cosmic rays, which we do not. And lastly, the cosmic ray spectral distribution. As I said, if we want to measure the ordering in the field, we need to divide two frequencies, the synchrotron emission at two different frequencies. And that is then going to entangle our measurement of the ordering of the fields with the spectrum of cosmic rays. And that turns out to be something interesting and also annoying. So this is a picture of the cosmic ray spectrum. So this is energy spectrum, energy of the cosmic ray versus, energy of the cosmic ray versus the number density of cosmic rays. And this is direct measurements of particle detectors in space. So for instance, the AMS, the blue points, is on space station. Fermi is the red point. So that's the Fermi gamma ray satellite, which not only measures diffuse gamma ray emission, but also can functions as a particle detector in space. Does the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy have any role in these magnetic fields? That is a very good question. Maybe. First, we're going to try to figure out what the fields look like, and then we'll try to figure out why, unless someone comes up with a very compelling reason. In general, from what we see of external galaxies, the magnetic fields of the supermassive black holes end up causing, you know, these very collimated jets that come out, like Sen'e that I showed you the really small picture of in the beginning. It's unlikely that it has anything to do with the field that we see that's parallel to the galactic plane near us. But it might be causing some confusion, which I might talk about later if I have time. So when we look at this cosmic ray spectrum, we see that it's fairly well measured up here and well modeled. The models are these black lines. But there's something funny going on down here. And this is the fact that when you directly measure cosmic rays at this energy in space, they roughly represent what you, the cosmic ray spectrum in the nearby region of the galaxy. But at this energy, what we're measuring near the Earth is affected by the sun. It's affected by the solar wind, and therefore the spectrum is modulated. And this is just a model for that modulation. But this is another area of astrophysics that we don't have a very accurate model of. So why do we care? Well, because our microwave bands are right about here. This is where the emission in the microwave bands, the synchrotron emission, is coming from. It's tracing this part of the cosmic ray spectrum. Whereas that radio map at 408 megahertz, that's tracing this part of the cosmic ray spectrum. So this curve, the exact shape of it, matters very much if we want to compute the ordering of the magnetic fields by dividing polarized and total intensity of synchrotron. So that's a challenge that connects the magnetic fields with cosmic ray physics and solar modulation and what's going on in the heliopause. I said that none of these models was very well connected to physics, although we're making a bit of progress with this, but we tend to be starting with totally ad hoc models, which are the ones, some of the ones I showed before, where we just say, well, okay, it's probably roughly spiral, so let's try to parameterize a set of spiral segments or something like that. Others are trying to do more sophisticated models. The ones on the left are theoretical models by a colleague of mine in Toulouse, which are in particular trying to reproduce the X-shaped fields that we see when we look at external galaxies edge-on. So in other words, the fields are doing something like this. They come down and go up across the galactic plane. And so that's an interesting thing, and we'd like to know whether it does that in our own galaxy, but that's not easy to see because we're not looking at our own galaxy from outside. We are looking at it edge-on, but from within it, which makes that harder to detect. The one on the right is a more interesting and much more physically motivated model based on magnetohydrodynamic simulations. And this is showing how you can generate things like field reversals. If you can see in here, parts of it are pointing one way and parts of it are pointing the other way. And these are some field lines showing you how, though it might be mostly parallel to the galactic plane in that plane, you can have other wacky things happening because essentially you need a divergence-free field. Things have to send excesses of helicity, for instance, elsewhere. This gets complicated. And I have some very interesting colleagues working on this. This is from my friend Anvar Shukarov in Newcastle. And I said that none of these models have been compared to each other. So suppose you have these six models that all produce roughly the same data sets. How do you decide which one is better? Which one is a more accurate reflection of reality? Well, this is just trying to do some such comparison of the possible different models you can construct and showing their chi-squares, which is a very simplistic way to do it, but it's at least a start. But what we'd like to do is do better, more quantitative and with the kind of statistics that take into account the differences, for instance, in the size of the parameter space, which matters very much when you're comparing two different model fits. Another thing I mentioned is the complexity of dealing with the turbulence. So if you're familiar with the problem of cosmic variance, I come at this from a CMB perspective from the start. The CMB is fluctuations, essentially, you know, quantum fluctuations on a primordial field that we see today. And we model them not by saying we expect to see a bright spot or a cold spot right here or right there, but statistically, we expect to see this number of bright cold spots and bright hot spots. And so it's a statistical analysis. But if you were to simulate a universe made from the exact same model as our own, it would not look exactly the same. So when you're comparing your model to the data, you need to take that into account. Our galaxy and our universe are just one realization of whatever that underlying model is. So I call this galactic variance in our galaxy because we're going to characterize the turbulence sort of statistically, but we're not going to try to fit a model that's going to represent the synchrotron emission in every little detail all across the galaxy. Instead, we're going to try to make a model that says the large scale field looks like this, and on top of that, you should see these kinds of fluctuations. And so it's very important to characterize those fluctuations, both because you want to understand the physics of the turbulence, and also because you need to understand how to statistically characterize how well your model fits the data. And that's very important to get right if you're going to compare two different models. And this is showing some work we did on the Planck paper showing what that variance looks like. This is essentially showing how much the synchrotron emission should vary compared to your model, how much you expect it to vary compared to your model because of the turbulence. And the top row is basically an estimate of that from observing the sky. And of course, we only have one galaxy. So how did we make that? Well, we just averaged the variations within a big pixel, within a big region of the sky, and said, well, all the variations within that, that's our estimate of the variance, because that's all we can do with the galaxy. But with theoretical models, we can generate 100 or 1,000 realizations and find the true variance of them. And so this is the kind of thing that you need to do if you want to get the statistics right. But it's also an observable in and of itself. If the magnetic fields are highly turbulent, then this variance goes up. So this is sort of another way to get a measurement of the ordering in the magnetic fields, in addition to this way I was talking about before, where you're comparing the polarization and the total intensity of the synchrotron emission. So it's another complementary view of the same property of the magnetic field. But real turbulence is difficult. And I'll get to that a little bit more, but just to summarize, in 2016, we published the Planck paper. So I was, as my introduction alluded to, I was on the Planck team for a long time, and I was supposed to put out the Planck magnetic field model paper. And instead, what we published was basically a paper showing all the gory details about why we can't say what the Planck magnetic field model is yet. It's too hard. There are too many degeneracies. We don't have enough information yet. Just with the Planck data and the data that existed at the time, it wasn't good enough. But we learned a lot about what we do need to solve this problem. So enough of the problems. How about some new tools? So we're going to look at some new ways of using traditional observables, new observables, new theoretical work, new numerical work, and importantly, new collaborations. So what do I mean? Let's take a look at some traditional observables, but looked at in a slightly different way. The map on the left is the starlight polarization I showed you again, but now we have Gaia, and Gaia is giving us accurate parallax distance measurements to the billion stars in our neighborhood, which means that we can get accurate distances to each of these polarization measurements, and we can increase the number of these polarization measurements. There are a few people trying to do that, but even with the Gaia data as it is, this data set becomes much more useful to us now. On the right is another way of looking at synchrotron emission. Each of those dots superimposed on this cartoon picture of the galaxy is an H2 region. This means a region of hot ionized gas. And what that does is absorb synchrotron emission in the radio. So if you have a diffuse synchrotron background and then you have a shadow on it caused by this H2 region. And the reason that's particularly useful is because you can get distances to H2 regions through spectroscopy. So you can say how much of that synchrotron emission is coming from behind that distance, which means you can start to do some 3D tomography. And in particular, this is what a PhD student of mine who just graduated was doing. And some of the models that I showed you, the three on the top of that set of six, are shown in color. These are the predictions for essentially the synchrotron background you would see from the shadows of these H2 regions compared to her data, which is the black line with the gray bars, and they don't match at all. This is very interesting. Why don't they match? We don't, at the moment, have a very good idea of this. It either implies that our model is very wrong in the inner galaxy or very wrong in the outer galaxy. At the moment, we can't really say which. Another thing that one of my colleagues is working on, Jennifer West, who worked on this when I was working with her when she was a PhD student, she's now moved on to many other interesting things. But this was one of the first things we worked on together, where we have a couple of hundred supernova remnants that we have observed the morphology in the radio. And you see these on the left. These are two of these supernova remnants that we've observed, and this is their radio emission. You see these radio lobes, this bilateral symmetry, where there's a bright limb on one side and a bright limb on the other side, and darkness on maybe the poles. So we were modeling this by blowing up supernova remnants inside a uniform magnetic field and then observing at them in different positions around the galaxy. And so for the two of those different models of the galactic magnetic field, we stuck the supernova remnants in the right places and observed them from the right angle to see which model could be made to reproduce that morphology of all those supernova remnants. We had like 150 of them or something. And the results surprised me. I did not think this would be very useful, but it turns out that one of those models, you're able to fit the orientation of that supernova remnant morphology reasonably well for most of the supernova remnant. And for the other, you couldn't do very well at all. So the morphology of these supernova remnants is basically saying this model is much better than this one. You can't reproduce them with this one. Another thing that I haven't talked too much about was the pulsars. This is just a better view of the pulsar information that some of these models are based on. These are the pulsars that we know about, labeled with a red X if they are positive, which means the field is pointing toward us, or a blue circle, which is a negative rotation measure, which means the field is pointing away from us. And these are the ones we know about, and these are all these extragalactic sources that made up that map that I was showing you, although there's more data over here that went into that map. But anyway, the point is that there are not really enough pulsars to get anything outside the fairly close neighborhood of the solar system. Another way of looking at that is this: the red points here are roughly the ones that we know about. But you may have heard of the Square Kilometer Array, which is being built in South Africa and Australia, and is going to, according to predictions, detect every single pulsar in the galaxy that is sweeping in our direction. So what it expects to see is the black dots. And that's going to be a complete game changer, because we can get, as I mentioned before, a distance to each one of these pulsars, in addition to the rotation measure. So we're going to get a much better handle on the 3D distribution of the coherent component of the galactic magnetic field. But we're going to have to wait a little while for that. Another thing that Gaia is giving us is 3D dust information. So I said Gaia is measuring precise distances to a billion stars in the solar neighborhood. It's also measuring the extinction. So from the spectra of these stars, you can see how much it's been reddened by the intervening dust, which means you can get a measure of how much dust is between you and that star. And you know where that star is, which means you're mapping out the dust. So this is one of the latest maps of the dust in our neighborhood. So this is going out 3 kiloparsecs in each direction. We're in the middle. You can see we're in this sort of evacuated region. And so this is very new, this kind of accuracy in the distribution of the dust. And so this is telling us where the dust is nearby, which means that we can then look at the Planck map again of the polarized dust emission and say, okay, that means that in this region of the sky, where we can see the polarization of the magnetic field, that must be at this particular distance. So we can again start to use the dust to get 3D information about the magnetic field. In terms of the cosmic rays, I mentioned this would be a weird and interesting problem. So on the left again is the problem where we couldn't measure or very well model the solar modulation. This is a plot that is similar, except it's actually multiplied by one fewer energy. So it's instead of a flat line, it's this line going down, but this is the same thing as this part. And then this is the solar modulation region that we don't understand very well. And this is Voyager data. So as you may know, Voyager has now left the solar system, Voyager 1, Voyager 2 as well, possibly at this point. I don't remember. But Voyager 1 is definitely passed through the heliopause and out into what we consider to be, as far as we know, typical interstellar space, which means that this measurement of the cosmic rays is indeed a good estimate of what the cosmic ray density is in our region of the galaxy. So we can now get this cosmic ray spectrum that we needed, if only locally. But this is going to very much help us pin down exactly the shape of the cosmic ray spectrum here, which means we can then compare our two synchrotron frequencies much more accurately to get a measurement of the ordering of the magnetic fields. Ultra high energy cosmic rays, as I said, was something that I'm increasingly interested in. These are things, one of these cosmic rays can have the energy of a baseball thrown at 100 miles an hour. These are incredible things. We see them in air shower arrays, essentially. They hit the atmosphere and cause showers of particles that we can then detect. And that helps us track them back to where the direction in the sky from which they came. Now, there's a very interesting transition that's occurring where we're observing right now. These red lines, this is just a toy model from another colleague of mine. At about 10 to the 18 electron volts, these cosmic rays will still be deflected in the galactic magnetic field. So this is just a cartoon showing how they're going to wander around in the galactic magnetic field, following the spiral lines before they get to the Earth. In other words, we have no idea where they came from. But above 10 to the 19, their rigidity becomes high enough that they almost come straight in. They will be deflected, but not by so much that we can't start to get an idea of where they came from, which means then we can use that deflection to study the magnetic field that deflected them. This is what that looks like. This is data from the Pierre Auger Observatory, which is spread out over hundreds of square kilometers, thousands of square kilometers in there's this high valley in Argentina, and I was very lucky to be able to visit it. It's a beautiful place. There's not much there except some ranchers, basically, and a bunch of particle detectors scattered over the landscape, in addition to a few telescopes looking at the Cherenkov radiation in the atmosphere. And so this is measuring these enormous air showers that come from these enormously high energy cosmic rays. So what does that look like? Well, this is showing the density, essentially, of cosmic rays detected on the sky with the small scale structure removed. So you're just looking at essentially a dipole. You're saying they're mostly coming from this region of the sky. And this is the center of that dipole. So in other words, most of the cosmic rays are coming from over here, from a region that's centered over there. So why is that interesting? Well, we think, you know, these must come from sources that are in galaxies, right? So what about the galaxy distribution on the sky? Well, this is the 2MRS galaxy survey. If you look at its dipole is basically right here. In other words, sort of the center of mass of where most of the galaxies are. Now, what happens if you imagine one of these galactic magnetic field models? So you have a dipole centered here in your distribution of sources of ultra high energy cosmic rays. Where would that dipole show up after it propagated through the galactic magnetic field of one of these models? Well, depending on the energy, it would show up either here or here, which means that we can start to use this information from galaxy surveys and the Pierre Auger ultra high energy cosmic ray detections to say which magnetic field model is more likely. I think this is going to be a very cool avenue of research. There's also other information in this map. As I said, the small scale structures have been removed, but they also have interesting information in them as well. So you can do more than just compare the dipole. You can actually start to do spatial cross correlations between the galaxy distribution and the cosmic ray distribution. There's a whole lot that's being done in turbulence. These are some MHD simulations that are helping us understand what the small scale turbulent structures of galaxies will look like. And this is very important to understand the statistics and the properties of the synchrotron emission that's coming from regions too small for us to simulate. So we're trying to create simulations of the galaxies and compare them to the observables. But no matter how powerful your supercomputer is, there's always going to be a scale on which you can't simulate it. You don't have enough computing power. And that's going to be a chunk of the galaxy that's going to have turbulence within that size, smaller than that size, that you cannot resolve, which means you need to study what that turbulence ought to look like according to known physics. And that's what these simulations are giving us. The other thing that they give us is when you include cosmic rays, you can start to do better than simply assuming that the cosmic rays are smoothly distributed. There's some indication that the turbulence is actually also affecting the distribution of cosmic rays. The cosmic rays essentially get trapped between magnetic mirrors in the turbulent interstellar medium. And so on the left, you're looking at essentially density contours of magnetic fields. And on the right, this is where all the cosmic rays are. And they turn out to, these tend to be in between structures from over here. And this is something that's not taken into account at all in the simulations that anybody has done, but needs to be. Oh, wait, I seem to have missed a message down here. Amateur question, did the observations from the Arecibo Observatory contribute to your knowledge base? It will, yes. One project I was involved in when I was in Manchester was the GALFAX survey. This was the Galactic Alpha Continuum something survey. Anyway, it was an Arecibo survey of a chunk of the galactic plane that had not been observed before in such detail. And the data are very slowly coming out. You can tell by the fact that I was in Manchester mumble 15 years ago. And the point there was to get a better sampling of Faraday rotation measures from extragalactic sources. It also gives us interesting views of the turbulence through the diffuse emission. And that was done with the Arecibo Observatory. And yes, we are all brokenhearted, absolutely. So the turbulence, subgrid modeling is basically what that's about, to understand what's going on at scales too small for us to simulate. So basically, if you're familiar with cosmology, again, I come back to my first field. Well, I guess it was my second field, technically. In cosmology, you may have seen plots like this where you have cosmological parameters like the age of the universe and the matter density of the universe and the ionization age of the universe, that sort of thing. And you're trying to constrain these parameters with a Bayesian framework where you sample your model space and compare it to the simulation, compare it to the data and see whether, for instance, you get a tight constraint on something or no constraint at all. Well, this is what it is. This is what we're doing with magnetic field models. This is, for instance, a simple model that was fit to the data. This is the total magnetic field strength. This is one, these are three different angles essentially that define the spiral structure essentially, and the spiral opening angle and whatnot. And these are parameters that determine things like the ordering of the magnetic field. And so you can see we're trying to constrain and or at least figure out which parameters we can constrain and which we can't. So this is how I like to explain this problem. It's the proverbial elephant. You have many different fields of astrophysics that have some observations, but they're not always talking to each other, and they relate to the other areas of astrophysics in complex ways that usually those particular subfields are not worrying about. So there are people that are studying dust emission. So I was really bored one night when I made this plot. This is the dust emission. So these people are looking at the magnetic fields and saying, well, it's a tree. And there are people who are looking at the synchrotron emission and saying, no, no, it's just like a big wall. And here are the air shower array people with the ultra high energy cosmic rays, and it's a sword. I mean, you're all familiar with this proverb, I assume. And here are the rotation measures. It's like a leaf or whatever. And so what we want to do is get all these people talking to each other. So this is where the Imagine collaboration comes in. This is called the Interstellar Magnetic Field Inference Engine. So what happened was somebody who works on Pierre Auger, an ultra high energy cosmic ray physicist, had an office next door to a radio astronomer friend of mine in the Netherlands. And they thought, they talked over coffee, as one does, and decided, hey, we should, you know, maybe see if we've got things to learn from each other about magnetic fields. And then they talked to some friends of ours who are big on Bayesian statistics. Bayesian statistics, the power of them is that you can really quantify how much you've learned instead of simply how good your fit is, because those are two very different questions. And a few other people, including myself, and we tried to get these people together all in a room and define all of the different things that we can do and how we can put them together. And we've made an infrastructure that we call, it's also just called the Imagine Pipeline. And this is sort of a schematic. So all these data that I've been talking about are over here, from the ultra high energy cosmic rays, the synchrotron emission, dust, rotation measures, et cetera. Your model's going up here. So you have a model for the galactic magnetic field and for the different particle distributions, or for instance, the distributions of ultra high energy cosmic ray sources. You put those models into a simulator, and then you compare them to the data and you get a likelihood out. And then you do that for many different models. And if you do them with the proper Bayesian statistics, you can actually tell which model is not just a better fit to the data, but by how much the information content is better. You can also plug in various theoretical knowledge about some of these parameters as priors. It's just a statistical way to add in information that, you know, you don't think it's very likely this parameter can't possibly be larger than this because that would violate such and such known physics. So you put that in statistically as a prior. So you can put all these things together into one framework, which we have built and that we're still working on. It has to be a fairly generic framework so people can plug in all of their favorite science fairly easily and make use of what the rest of us have contributed to this framework. So, you know, I will be contributing codes that compare the polarized synchrotron emission from the models. You know, we have a code that I've been working on for over a decade that takes the galactic magnetic fields, the cosmic rays, the electrons, and the dust, and produces maps of rotation measure, dust emission, and synchrotron emission. So that's like my part of it. And I've got colleagues now in through Imagine who are working on ultra high energy cosmic rays, so like those Pierre Auger maps. We've got people who are working on dynamo and MHD theory who are going to tell us what we need to assume about the smallest scales of turbulence, et cetera. We code in many languages. This simulator is coded in C++, and the infrastructure over the top is all Python. So basically, all these pieces we've been talking about fit in somewhere. These are galactic magnetic field models, plus non-parametric models are something we hope to do. These are all the maps that I've been talking about and the rotation measures of pulsars. This is the cosmic ray information that you can put in as a model for your cosmic rays, or you can put it in as an observable and then fit the model of the cosmic rays with additional degrees of freedom. You can put in the ultra high energy cosmic rays, et cetera. You can put in the MHD simulations into information about how the turbulence should look on small scales. And or you can put those in, you can actually take MHD simulations and put them into your sky simulations, although this is going to be more challenging because for this framework, you're going to need to simulate this a million times, whereas each one of these simulations takes many CPU hours. So we're going to have to figure out a much cleverer way of doing that, where we're going to extract the statistical information from these very heavy, intensive simulations and find some way of codifying it in something that we can do in a second. So that's the plan. And we have a framework and we have a whole bunch of people and a lot of interesting data to put together. And I'm just going to leave you with a caveat. this is a story about me and Torsten, basically. Torsten is one of my colleagues. That's me in the middle saying, our field has been struggling with this problem for years. Galactic magnetic fields are difficult. And here comes Torsten. He's a Bayesian and an information field theorist. And he says, struggle no more. I'm here to solve it with algorithms. He thinks we can solve this with non-parametric Bayesian modeling because he does information field theory. It's his thing. And then we sit down and his grad student, Teo, and then another postdoc of ours, Luis, have been sitting down for a few years. And instead of 6 months, I'm afraid it has been a few years. Wow, this problem is really hard. Yeah, you don't say. So this is not a project for a year or two. This is a project for a decade. But there's a lot of information on the horizon, a lot of new data sets on the horizon, a lot of things that we can put together. And the thing that I like the most about Imagine is putting together all these people that otherwise wouldn't have talked to each other. I mean, it's not just that I got to visit the OJ facility in Argentina. That was really cool. But actually, I really enjoy visiting my colleagues in Newcastle. And I got to tell you, Newcastle's, you know, it's not a great place. But visiting these colleagues and having these conversations with people in totally different fields where you're all interested in magnetic fields is really the part that I like about it. So essentially, I will just say, watch this space. I hope that someday we will have, we will be coming out with better information about galactic magnetic fields as we put all of us together and study this big elephant. So thank you. If you have more questions, please feel free to unmute or type them into the chat. I've been trying to keep an eye on that. But that's
all. I have a question.
Go ahead.
The bottom line, as I see it, is to study the structure of the galactic magnetic field. So far, with the data that we have, we can only do that locally, even with Gaia. How are we going to do it for the rest of the galaxy?
It's not true that the only information we have is local. When you look at these synchrotron maps, they are integrated through the entire galaxy. So this is covering the entire galaxy. And in particular, one of these observables that I was trying to explain, this one, these H2 regions, we've got information on the synchrotron emission on the far side of the galactic center. So with basically clever tricks like this, given to us by these extraordinarily interesting phenomena like H2 regions creating a shadow in the synchrotron emission, we are probing the other side of the galactic center. So we are able to probe far more than just our local region. It's true that we have more information about our local region, but that's not the only
information. We have enough pulsars on the other side of the galaxy to give us reasonable resolution.
Not yet.
Not yet, so right. Well,
this is us. So the red pulsars we've got, this is the galactic center. The black is what we expect from the SKA. So yes, with the SKA, we expect to get all of the pulsars. They've quoted all of the pulsars. We will get them with the SKA, supposedly. I'm sure they're not promising something that they can't deliver, right?
What causes the wedge in the black for the thing that isn't here yet? Is it the ground blocking?
Both of the facilities that were chosen, there was a big competition between Australia and South Africa. And in the end, they could not make either of them lose. So they've split the observatory up. But neither one of them can get the northern sky.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Is the North Polar Spur part? Okay, hold on. Oh, what a loaded question. I need an extra slide for that one. Where is that one? I had that back here. There we go. Here. All right. This one. So is the North Polar Spur part of the Fermi bubbles? That depends who you ask. We're having a wonderful fight over this issue. This is the North Polar Spur. This particular map is this is WMAP, but it's been processed by the SPAS people. The SPAS people did a southern sky survey, so they got this part even better. These outlines are roughly the Fermi bubble.
Now, we don't see your screen. We don't see your screen.
Okay.
We see you and you're beautiful, but still, we'd like to see your brain.
No, that's not what I want to show. Right, okay. Let me solve this brief technical issue. That's, now I have to share again. Apparently it unshared when I tried to change the view. All right, how's that?
There we go.
Okay, let's start over. This one down here, this is WMAP data. This is the North Polar Spur. And these are the outlines of the Fermi bubble, these black lines, if you can see them. So Coretti et al. Claimed, yes, what you see in the radio data is you see a bunch of spurs. There's one here, there's one here, there's one here, there's one here. In fact, this is another colleague of mine tried to identify all the different spurs you see in the radio, and there are a lot of them. And so the question is, yeah, which of them might have something to do with the Fermi bubbles? So before the Fermi bubbles, people looked at the North Galactic Spur, and they see that it goes almost all the way up to the North Galactic Pole. If that is originating at the galactic center, that's a bloody big thing. And people did not believe that that could be energetically realistic. Now the Fermi people, since they've had the Fermi, seen the Fermi bubbles, and the SPAS people, because they've found a spur that lines up with the edge of one of the Fermi bubbles on one side, are starting to say, well, this is a heck of a coincidence. And then there's a figure I don't even have here. I don't know if any of you have seen the relatively recent results from E-Rosita, but E-Rosita is showing the X-ray emission from this area. And they are again saying, this is way too much of a coincidence. The North Polar Spur has to be the edge of this galactic scale outflow that's coming from the supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. Except that I know a lot of radio people, and they've been studying this thing for a long time. And they are pretty certain that it's not more distant than a couple hundred kiloparsecs tops. You can see, for instance, the starlight polarization that I showed. Those stars are not at the galactic center, and yet their polarization reflects the North Polar Spur. So somewhere in here is a heck of a coincidence, but we don't know which way it is yet. We're having a wonderful debate about it. It's a very good question.
What's not more distant than a couple of hundred kiloparsecs?
This, whatever the origin of this radio emission right here.
Okay.
The North Polar Spur. So the X-ray people and the Fermi people, they have not been studying this in the radio for decades, so they don't believe that. But the radio people that have been studying it for decades are pretty sure that it cannot be further than a couple of kiloparsecs.
Couple of kiloparsecs. Okay, that's more like it. The whole galaxy is only 100 kiloparsecs.
What did I say? I must have said the wrong thing. A couple of kiloparsecs.
Okay. That's
and then there's the starlight polarization. So all of these stars are showing exactly that they are... The polarization to these stars is aligned with the North Polar Spur, which is going right up here. And these stars are definitely not at the galactic center. These are very nearby. So we're having fun with this one.
You've done a marvelous job to put all this stuff together. So many different types of measurements and everything. That's a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Oh, well, congratulate us. We haven't done anything yet. We're just trying.
Well, you're on the verge.
We're working on it. Yes, we are tackling a hard problem. Definitely.
I'm going to ask you a question a little bit from left field.
Okay.
I remember I'm old. I got lots of gray hair, right? I'm 70. But I'm still in the workforce. I'm still teaching astronomy 101. So, and while this was a great talk, obviously my students couldn't handle it. But I remember people talking about equal partition of energy, how the amount of energy in starlight, the amount of energy in the magnetic field in the galaxy and the magnetic, you know, but I can't find any of that stuff anymore. Well, of course, part of it's the pandemic and my books that have that.
in a place I haven't been to since March of last year.
I'm not going to be able to answer your question. So many people, because they can't do anything else, you take a synchrotron map and you know that it has to do with the magnetic fields and the cosmic rays, but you don't know the radius. So you assume equipartition because it makes it easier. And equipartition has many things going for it. In many contexts, it seems very likely that these systems are in equipartition. But there's increasing worry about this assumption because there are systems that are not in equipartition. And we don't have a lot of solid evidence of where things are and are not in equipartition. So it's an assumption that we used to make everywhere simply because we couldn't do any better. And we don't actually know just how wrong that is. It might not be too wrong, but it might be. So that's why I'm trying not to assume equipartition. I'm trying to find information about the cosmic rays and the magnetic fields separately. And then if I can basically tell the theorists, okay, this is the strength of the field and this is the density of the cosmic rays, you tell me how that fits together, because is it in equipartition? Is it not? If not, why not?
If the cosmic rays and the magnetic fields have not cohabited for a long time, you wouldn't expect equipartition.
It depends on time scales, which we don't understand very well, in particular dynamo time scales. So dynamo theory is how you say, how do you generate and maintain a magnetic field for so long that it's basically, you know, got a galactic scale morphology. And we're not entirely clear how to do that. So the time scales involved tend to change depending on your theoretical simulation. And of course, our knowledge about how long the cosmic rays stick around at what energies is also imperfect. We've got a pretty good idea of how synchrotron losses work. But we don't necessarily, in fact, there's a problem with the cosmic rays in that all the models predict that there should not be very many cosmic rays in the outer galaxy, because we think that they come from things like supernova. They're accelerated through, you know, Fermi acceleration in the expanding shell of a supernova remnant, for instance. Most of the star formation is in the inner galaxy, which means that's where most of the supernova are. And from what we know about synchrotron losses and cosmic ray propagation, the outer galaxy should not have very many of them left, but Fermi tells us that there are still a lot out there. So that's a big problem no one knows how to solve. So I've got Fermi collaborators who are telling me what to do with the Fermi data. And some of them basically just say, yeah, well, we just stuck in this fudge factor and we don't understand it, but it seems to work.
Might not AGN be sources of ultra high energy cosmic rays?
Ultra high energy ones, yes. Consider the ultra high energy cosmic rays totally different beasts from the synchrotron emitting cosmic rays. Totally different populations. But yes, one is entirely galactic and the other is entirely extragalactic, as far as we know.
Yeah, do these galactic magnetic fields have any effect on the Earth?
Probably not. They're very weak compared to the sun and the Earth's magnetic fields themselves. So, you know, the Earth is essentially carving out its own protective bubble in the region of the solar system where otherwise, you know, we'd be hammered by cosmic rays from the sun, and it protects us from cosmic rays in general. And the sun is carving out its own bubble as it moves through the interstellar medium. But all of this is much too small to have any effect on the galaxy as a whole. However, it's a very interesting question to study the magnetic field morphology near the solar system and further away. And so there's something called, it's either IBEX or EBEX, it starts with an I, I don't remember how it's actually meant to be pronounced, which is trying to study the magnetic field shape that's sort of in the immediate vicinities of the solar neighborhood. And then you can see how that connects with, you know, the mappings I was showing of like the dust in the solar neighborhood. So they're eventually going to intersect. what happens on Earth doesn't have any effect on the galactic magnetic field, but there's some connection. At some point, you basically go from a very local phenomenon to a more large-scale phenomenon. We don't know exactly where that happens. If that answers your question.
There's even a planetarium program. For those of us that run planetariums, on the mission that you just mentioned, that I'd never heard anything else before. But where you get a hold of that, if you're not in a planetarium, I'd have no idea. And I couldn't even do it right now because mine's under construction again and demolition.
You mean EBEX?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember seeing a show on that.
Okay. I saw a paper about it.
If I find a reference to that,
yes, send it to
I will email it to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Because it would at least tell you how to say the word carefully because it was designed for small children. The show.
Okay.
But at some level, we're all small children.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel pretty odd when I do this stuff. I feel like I've been getting smaller in my career. I started out with the entire universe with the CMB, and now it's only the galaxy. So, you know, when people talk to me about the sun, it's too small. I'm not interested. A certain snobbery of scale.
Yeah, listen, if I were to confess, I would talk about quantum gravity. So talk about somebody who was foolish in their selection of a topic a long time ago.
Yeah, the hard one.
Right here.
Yep.
I've had a lot of fun anyway.
That's the point. So the point is just whether you can get a job doing what you love.
Yeah.
And we'll just clarify.
Who knows?
Good.
I'm not
currently associated with the University of Maryland. I was when I first got here. But as of April last year, I'm a civil servant at Goddard. I feel kind of sad that I'm no longer connected with the university. It makes it harder to have any contact with students and things like that. And I really like the department and university, but basically as a civil servant, I mean, my work is now dominated by a day job. So I don't get a lot of time for this research anymore. I actually love my day job. We do a lot of, it's technology to make data available for people. But
you can still teach at the university part-time.
Yeah. And my spare time, not going to happen.
Pays peanuts. It pays less than peanuts. Although if you have enough peanuts, you can make peanut butter. I am a member of an adjunct labor union, but I have a full-time staff job as planetarium director and physics, science and engineering technology coordinator. So as you know, somebody who's had to cobble together.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, so this project is fascinating to me, and I wouldn't say I have any regrets, and it's just involves so many different parts of astrophysics. I really like it. On the other hand, it is very difficult to come out with 3 papers a year on this kind of a project. And so,
of course,
I don't
think... Are you required to do that as a civil servant?
No.
I don't think so.
See, that's the nice thing about the community college. I wasn't pressured to do that, see? So sometimes, remember, Nancy Grace Roman, who, you know, the mother of the Hubble, who's dead now, but she was a longtime member of this organization.
Oh, yeah?
She said very early that she realized that she couldn't get tenure as a woman. See, she graduated in 1947, right? That's 3 years from even I'm born. But she could, the government was more friendly for women at that time. So she could go into there and do some real stuff. And she ended up doing great stuff. And she got the junk data from the University of Chicago, too. If you talk to her, she had an advisor who didn't talk to her for 6 months at the University of Chicago. You talk about poor treatment of advisors. At least I didn't have that problem, you know.
I'm sure she faced challenges in the government, too. But
Nancy,
because her advisor was a very famous person who
never good
was very, very busy.
Yeah, you don't want a super
advisor. Was Morgan of the Morgan Spectra.
Yeah, that's Wayne Warren, who's now in Florida. So a lot of our members have scattered to the wind.
And still teaching online astronomy at the University of Maryland.
Right.
Tess, Vera Rubin was also a long-term member. Both she and Nancy used to come to pretty much all our meetings.
Nancy more so than Vera. But
yeah.
Vera was a member when she was a teenager in the 40s.
Yeah.
Changed his name.
I'm glad I didn't know that ahead of time or I would have been intimidated. Somebody wants to ask a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got several questions. This may be stupid, but let me try. What's the relationship between the so-called cosmic ray halo or gamma ray halo of the galaxy and the galactic magnetic field? That's one of them. And the other is, do you have any further observations on the topology of the universe since you last gave a presentation at the observatory a couple of years ago? And where can we find your most recent writing on the shape of the universe?
Did I mention I don't have much time for research anymore?
I understand. Okay. I understand completely.
All right. First question. I'm going to paraphrase Mark Twain here. I'm delighted to be able to answer this question. I do not know. I don't know if you know that quote. He was delighted to be able to answer the question. He said, I did not know. The relationship between the gamma ray halo and the magnetic field, completely unknown. Second question, nope. One reason I switched from CMB to galactic stuff is, God, this is going to sound colossally arrogant or something. I felt that I had done everything I could do with the CMB. And no, there have been no new CMB data since then. So Planck was the legacy cosmic microwave background total intensity mission. Now, there's still stuff to do with the CMB. In particular, what we're chasing after is one number. It's called R. It is the ratio, the tensor to scalar ratio in the early universe, essentially the ratio of different types of fluctuations, which will tell us something about inflation and which manifests itself as a polarization signal in the cosmic microwave background. Okay. Now you can imagine that that is very difficult to detect. And that is what people are currently in a race to do. You may have heard that BICEP thought that they had detected it and were, you know, ironing their suits for their Nobel Prizes and everything. And then it turned out they'd gotten their dust wrong. Ah. So this is not an easy thing to do. And I decided that that was not interesting enough for me. I didn't want to spend the next decade of my life chasing a single number. So I prefer the galaxy because there's a lot of different stuff in here and it's all interesting. So no, I don't do shape of the universe stuff anymore, although I kind of miss it just because it was really cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to follow. I've been reading Andre Lin's article on cosmic expansion, and he's got R in there in various ways. It's really difficult to follow, to tell you the truth.
Christ. Sorry. Dennis had a question. Dennis, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thank you. I was curious where we could get further information about this, like papers, or you mentioned the pipeline, like perhaps there's a repository for that.
So what we've written that might be the best is a white paper. You'll have to Google it. You can Google my name, imagine magnetic fields. You should find it. There's a white paper that describes essentially the whole project that we're trying to do. And it essentially reviews all the different physics, and then it has citations to all the different things in it, basically. So that's the best place to start right at the moment.
You can go to the Astrophysics Data System website at Harvard and put her name in and you'll get all her papers.
It's the one that's basically titled Imagine.
Actually, I'll
Yep, thank you.
I'll send Dennis the link to that system.
There's a lot of information in there. It was written by, you know, it's what happens when you get 20 astrophysicists together to write a paper.
Nancy Grace Ruttman and Wayne Warren both worked in the data center for NASA at one time, really? I might mention.
Yes, you worked for me, which is incredible.
She worked for me too one summer.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, like hiring.
She knew star catalogs, and I needed somebody who was familiar with star catalogs, and she wanted to learn computer programming. So we fit together very well.
She took Fortran at the local community college so she could learn how to do certain things.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we ever get a planetarium at the Rockville campus, I want to make sure it's named after her. The first one, the one that I'm at, gets named after Vera because she actually taught here. Can you believe that? She taught at a community college, right? Live long and prosper.
Yeah.
She also taught at a high school for a while.
Yeah. So, I mean.
All right. I put the link to the white paper in the chat.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, that's great.
Well, let's thank our speaker.
Thank you very much for all the great.
Clap.
Yeah. Terrific talk. Thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you for the invitation and for the information about the great other people who have been involved with your organization.
Thank you very much.
I said this was the most unusual astronomy club. I was not joking. Yeah.
It's an honor to be here then.
We've got journalists here. We've got lawyers. Uh-oh. We've got, you know, all of us at some level are amateur astronomers, and that we have a telescope that we occasionally use somehow for little kids.
Well, you know, my dad's an actual amateur astronomer as well. He likes to say that he knows more about building telescopes than anyone who has never done it before.
Yeah.
It was going to be his retirement project, but in the end he bought one, which is really nice. He likes it very much. But the difference is that if you look up at the sky, I mean, Elizabeth knows this from when I came to, you know, one of the star party nights. You look up at the sky and someone asks me, what's that? I have no idea. Not a clue. I'm not really an astronomer. I don't know what that is or where to find the other thing. Like, you know, the Cygnus Loop is a great supernova remnant. We've written papers on it. I couldn't tell you where it is on the sky. I mean, I could look it up, but.
You can't tell us where Cygnus is? The big cross in the northern sky? You have to go out and observe some.
I know. That's what my dad tells me to. Yeah. I do it all from the computer.
Actually, Harold can correct me on this, but iPhones used to have an app where you could aim it. Okay.
That's the only way I can impress my children is I pull out the app and I say, oh, yeah, that's.
Okay.
I use that in class.
Yeah,
face to face, which obviously isn't now, but
picture earlier the Whirlpool Galaxy. Do you know where the Whirlpool Galaxy is?
Nope. Sorry.
It's at the end of the Big Dipper. It's really easy to find.
Okay, someday this pandemic will be over, and you guys can show me these things, right?
Yeah.
Amen. My dad is down to the best. He can do this all without his iPhone. But you guys, I think, have bigger telescopes.
Join the club.
May do that.
Go to the
it'll only cost you $10 a year. We're not very expensive.
And well,
everything is free.
I think my daughter is now old enough that she might want to come with me, and that'll be a good excuse.
Good.
Well, eventually we'll have Exploring the Sky in Rock Creek Park. Stop by there too.
When the pandemic is over and we have meetings again at the University of Maryland Observatory. After the talk, if it's a clear night, the three large telescopes are pointing to three different objects. And
Tess
has given an open house talk a couple of times, so she's very familiar with the rough agenda of the program.
I think I had bad luck with weather, though. I think it wasn't great the one night or either night, and we could only see the very brightest things. But I love looking at planets, too, honestly. But if you guys can show me M51, I would love to see M51. My dad's never showed me N51.
With my ancient eyes, I can see maybe two or three stars when I look for my backyard. Of course, I live in Bethesda, which is... And what's even worse, I volunteer at the Air and Space Museum. You want a beautiful sky, go down there.
No, I need to go visit my father. I'm going to get my second vaccine shot, then I'm going to go visit my dad. He's in Prescott, Arizona, which is high altitude.
That's a beautiful place.
And he's got a new telescope.
Prescott is excellent. It's not a big city, but it's
exactly. It's got good viewing.
Yeah,
it's great.
We're in Fountain Hills, Arizona, so we're close to Prescott.
Oh wow! Yeah, it's a lovely area. I like visiting him.
There's M51 on the screen.
There it is. I'm just trying to look at the coordinates, but you guys use weird coordinates. I'm used to galactic.
The coordinates are not listed in here right now. These are just the pixel values or whatever. This is a raw frame. I did a Messier marathon a couple weeks ago, and I only got one quick image. And this is the raw image that came out.
Beautiful. It's beautiful.
Just with a little 6-inch telescope, 2 minutes.
Okay, then maybe my dad can show me that. We'll see.
Elizabeth can do real magic.
Yeah, or I don't know who will get to it first. Maybe my dad, because like I said, as soon as I get my second vaccine, I'm probably going to get on an airplane. But I'll be at the Star Nights one of these days. Maybe we can see it there. All right, I need to go see if my children are tearing up my house downstairs.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Happy skies.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thank you for coming out, and we'll see everyone next month.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
We'll see y'all.
Thank you
again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
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 Right, I'm going to be logging off as well because I got Jerry's here, and I'm going to go get a little dinner and stuff. So I'm going to be logging off as well. In other words, y'all need to log off.
Okay.
See you later, Elizabeth.
All right, y'all take care. Bye.
Bye.